Hi everyone, this is Richard from Wild Food People. This is a bit of an intro to this episode. So we have as a guest this week, John Miller. John Miller's new book, What's in a Year? A Countryman's Tale Through the Seasons, is, well, it's how we started this conversation, but everything just sort of carried on from there because John is a really fascinating guy and he lives in a beautiful corner of England, where he has got a real connection to the landscape, got a real connection to the nature there. And this conversation kind of reflects that. We went on from talking about the book to talking more broadly about conservation, talking about the issues with salmon farming and the conservation and ecological effects of that. We talked about the natural history GCSE, and we just talked about connections to wild, connections to food, and why all of those things are important. I think you're really going to enjoy this episode, and you can find all of the links to everything we talk about in the show notes for this episode. You'll find it on your podcast app, wherever you're listening to your podcast. And if you want to show support for this show, then you can go along and like it and review on whichever podcast app you use to get your podcasts. Right, I'm going to shut up. And I'm going to leave you with two men talking in possibly the finest man cave, escape corner, garden room, whatever you might want to call it. It's a beautiful place, this. Because are we in Wiltshire here?
Well, we are in Wiltshire here, but we're in a little special little place in Wiltshire at this very moment.
Yeah, this particular room we're in.
This particular room we're in has taken me 35 years to put together.
Yeah.
So this was, there's a fishing lodge I know from Scotland. I've been there with the same mates for 30 plus years. And I always wanted to replicate that down here. Mm. And this is it. So when I can't go fishing anymore, there's no more salmon there, whatever it is, I come here, we can plan things in here.
So this is a physical space that could take you to being somewhere else.
We always talk about sense of place.
Yeah.
This is my sense of place. And I might just say, so people listening understand, is it was a man shed originally. Yeah. But then my wife said, well, hang on, her girls like coming here. And then my teenage son says, well, my mates like coming here. So it's just the shed. Now, it's called the shed. But the thing I love building it because I just got a guy built. He just got the wood and built it. But if you want to replicate something old, it's the smells. It's the smells of some of those old fishing huts. Yeah. And you can't do that, obviously, with modern wood. But by getting reclaimed timber, which we got here, I'm sniffing it. Every time I come in here, I just sniff the smell of the wood.
We sort of a scratch and sniff podcast. I don't know how that would work with an audio file. This is a great place, but it's a reflection of your personality from what I've seen as well. And this is only the second time I've met you.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Because we met in this secret place somewhere in the north of England that we're not allowed to say exactly where it was.
That's right.
Yeah. Which was it's part of the Why Moorlands Matter event. And John and I were both invited up there to, because it's not really to speak, it's just to be part of the event and share your views, wasn't it? And to learn.
Yeah. And to learn. So it's a secret place, but it was a managed moor.
Yeah.
And to learn what is living there in the spring, because everyone always talks about August the 12th, but wow, the rare birds and the nests we found and the chicks and the, it's just amazing, amazing place. And because we just all have to talk more. We have to get away from this us and them and all the rest of it.
Yeah, this is... It's that thing we find with our work on every aspect of things that we do, that the more you talk to people, you find out, oh, actually, maybe they're not aligned with the thing you thought they were, even if it's what you thought your thing was. But that if you keep drilling past that point and further into the conversation, you find common ground, you find a way to see something in the same way. You might even change your views as you talk to them, but that has to be that long conversation, doesn't it? It can't just be an interaction on Twitter or X or whatever it's called now.
And you also have to build up a bit of a relationship as well, which helps, because so much of stuff these days is on Twitter or wherever. So there is no relationship between the two people having an argument, whatever they're talking about. Yeah. As you said, it's only a second time you've met me, but I thought to know me, come into this room, then you'll know me a bit better.
So give us a quick rundown of your life then. So you were born somewhere and then what?
Yeah, I was born somewhere.
Yeah. In a place.
A long time, a place. In High Wycombe, in 1960. So it's 65 years ago. And I had a lovely childhood. I was just out. My father was an actor. And he always described himself as an out-of-work actor, and it seemed he was. He had a few big films, but it was very, money came in sporadically. And so I had no pocket money. So all my pocket money was out shooting rabbits. I would say poaching pheasants. Mm. The thought of going on a pheasant shoot, I couldn't afford that, or salmon fishing. Oh. And that's part of why I have all these books, my old books, because I just bought these old books and just dreamt of one day, can I do this and fish? Wow, imagine catching a salmon with a thunder and lightning in a named pool. It was way beyond me. So I do get to do some of that, which is wonderful. So I've always been really rooted to the countryside, but I then spent my whole career in IT. Mm. I spent a lot of time in America, particularly in Texas. People would have heard of Dell Technologies. And when that came to an end a couple of years ago, it was like, now, finally, two things. One, I can really get back and look at nature, but how can I help? How can I give something back to nature? Because it's always grounded me. I had quite a high-profile job in the past. Mm. That was always there as my grounding. So I'm after a long and circuitous route, I'm sort of back to my roots now.
Was that something that you knew as you were coming out of that career, that you... Did you have a sort of an off ramp in your head of I'm moving towards this? Okay, this is another step towards this.
Yeah, the off ramp I had is I built up a garden tool business called My Garden Spud. I've just literally sold it last week. It's very small, but it's like it's the old fashioned D handle, how they made tools in Victorian times with a strapped handle, so there's no single point of failure with a socket. Mm-hmm. Lovely old tools, but I never really had much time to spend on it. And it sort of ticked along. And I think, to be honest, I probably got a bit bored with it because I started this about 6-7 years ago. And so it was the off-ramp, it was sort of that, but then I sold it. And then I just started writing. And I started writing because I could suddenly do all these things. So each month of the year, and I became a... This was deliberate. So I became a trustee of Atlantic Salmon Trust, a Curlew charity, Curlew Action, and started writing on Scribehound. And then I go and see these most extraordinary things all around the country and say, I've got to tell people about this. I've got to get this message out on, you know, the new norm is so bad compared to what the normal was when I was a kid growing up and all the wildlife we had. And people talk about biodiversity all the time. They talk about climate change all the time. And I know these are very important. They don't talk so much about bioabundance. And just the fact we have so few sparrows, why do we worry about really rare things when we have, what about our sparrows? They could probably a better indicator species than some animal that's always been rare in the UK, let's say.
So much focus goes on to one thing that people have been told to focus on, that something that was every day slips away unnoticed.
And it's a lovely thing, right? Because you just sort of get out everything that's in your head. And obviously not in a rant way.
No,
it's not a rant way, because then you go through it. And it's just a lovely thing to do. And it's your way of sharing stuff.
Yeah. You get that. Well, I do. I get that itch in my brain. It's like I'm just driving somewhere and I get an idea for an article or an idea for a post. And then that's it. It is going to be eating away at my brain until I get something written down about it. And if I don't get the chance to write it down before it drifts away as an idea, I will feel almost like a sense of loss, because I think, no, that was important. That was something to write. It hijacks you.
And you'll just see something and you want to share that with something. Amazing. Like this afternoon, there was a massive rare down in the garden here. And we have about, I don't know, seems like 50 pairs of jackdaws nesting in the lime trees down the bottom. Anyway, this time of year, a buzzard comes and takes all the young daws. Yeah. So the buzzard comes in and there's, 50 pairs, that's 100 jackdaws. They're all going nuts. And this buzzard's like trailing this poor jackdaw fledgling across the field and can hardly fly with all these crows and things attacking. But it's seeing all those amazing things every day. And The majority of people, though, don't see that. I did a little thing with BBC Wiltshire today talking about my book. I said, look, on the way here to the studios, I drove along the road, there's a green field and there's a brown wood. And probably most people, they just see a green field and a brown wood and maybe a couple of crows. But there's so much that people don't see. So that's the other bit. I'm just trying to get people to see more what's there.
There's a word I've heard you use, which is, or a phrase, sporting naturalist. So can you try and explain what that means to you?
Yeah, it sums me up well, and it sums up also some of the things I don't like in shooting at the moment as well. So if I go shooting, I'm there really to see everything, and then the shooting's a sort of cream on the top, if you like. Mm. And if you've ever been on a shoot where the only cream is killing a bird, and that person doesn't understand that bird or the nature around them or the plants they've got around them and all the rest of it that's going on, they shouldn't be there.
Yeah.
I think what they've got in Germany is quite good, and some of these sort of licenses you've got to shoot and you have to actually understand more about stuff. We let any, and part of the love of this country is like you can be a captain of a boat, can't you? You just get in a boat. You don't have to have any.
Oh, yeah.
You can do whatever you like.
Yeah.
And I love this country. Yeah. Just sail off, whatever, in a tub. But I think we've got to a point where we should probably have something there, because you get people coming in that haven't been brought up in it all their life. Mm. And to not know, understand, and appreciate everything around you, you shouldn't really be doing it. And then, of course, you come to eating it as well.
Yeah, it's a really contentious issue, but I've said before that I would be happy for there to be an examination or for there to be a knowledge test on both on safety and on natural history and the context of shooting within that wider framework in order to access firearms for shooting. Yeah. If you weren't interested in that, you can go target shooting.
Yeah, and you know, when you do your you have a doctor signs you off for your license, or whatever, and a policeman comes around and interviews you.
Yeah.
And all they want to know is, have you got a gun safe hidden away somewhere, locked in there? But they don't actually, there's nothing about, do you know what you're shooting or when you're shooting, what it is, how it lives, and all that? Nothing.
Yeah. You see that sometimes at club level, like wildfowling clubs won't let you out on your road until you can identify something at 70 miles an hour as it flies past. In a gale.
No, exactly, and which is right. So that's joining that club.
Yeah.
But I don't think many lowland pheasant stroke partridge shoots syndicates ask that of their members. But then there's probably the big difference in wildfowling, because you are harvesting a completely wild creature.
Yeah, and that's another issue of at what point is it wild food versus just a very elaborate farming operation.
Yeah,
for pheasants and things like that, which is not necessarily to say, well, it's a wrong, you should ban it immediately, but it is there is a difference between wild birds and game birds that are released.
And I think you appreciate the wild birds more, which you should do, especially as a naturalist. I only go pheasant shooting two or three times a year now, and not big days. I wouldn't go on a big day particularly. I tend to go more stalking these days. Mm. And here in Wiltshire it's great because we have, you can get fallow, roe and muntjac all in one day.
Yeah.
And I love the cleanliness of that. Mm. You take the shot or you don't take the shot, and you only take it if you're absolutely sure you're going to kill it straight away, so dead. And the cleanliness of doing that, and you are just harvesting.
How much of what you shoot do you eat?
Well, there's nothing I shoot that
it's everything.
I don't eat.
Yeah, yeah. That's
yeah.
It's 100%.
Yeah. Otherwise, I by the way, I totally understand people don't like shooting. I totally get it. Mm. But if I was sitting there saying, oh, John, I really don't like shooting, I said, well, I love it, I should say. And then I said, yeah, and I don't eat any of it. Like, what argument have I got?
Yeah. There's a conversation I had, I think it was last year, in sort of one of the bits of woodland we rent, and I was doing some work there on the gateway, and this guy came past in the car and came screeching halt and reversed up, and then was asking basically who I was. I think he was trying to find out whether I was a figure of authority, and said, no, I'm not. it transpired that he was going basically poaching in the river. He wanted to go fishing without paying for it. And I started talking to him about, okay, on the food aspect. He goes, oh no, I don't eat any of this stuff. I really hate the smell of fish. I've got these gloves I use to handle the fish because I just don't like the smell of the fish. And I was thinking, you are so disconnected from that activity. You might as well be going out to pull stuff out of a pond somewhere.
Yeah.
You know, the obviously that environment
gloves on.
doesn't hates the smell of fish. And I've met quite a few sporting anglers who actually, they hate the smell of fish.
Years ago, I took it 30, 40 years ago, right? You'd catch a salmon and eat it. It's just the most wonderful thing. And they always combine the same time as when my new potatoes were ready. And it's superb. Anyway, then we started getting given a bottle of whiskey because we were putting them back. But then the estates realised that was a bit expensive. I mean, a bottle of whiskey for a whole salmon. And then we didn't get a bottle of whiskey for that. And then we were allowed to kill a sea trout. And of course, then the sea trout got killed too much because they couldn't get that. Anyway, we don't kill anything now. So what is it? Why do I go salmon fishing, sea trout fishing? So I love to eat it. I love to, but we don't do it for obvious reasons. When you catch, it's just the most magnificent creature because it's from a different world. Mm. It's not your world. And nowadays, you know how we're also dead. We don't put them on a bank or anything like that. We're in the water and I hook them, hold them. So you sort of don't even bring them into your world. You just slightly lift them up a bit. And the privilege of having seen that salmon or sea trout, whatever it is, and put it back. But to think of holding it in gloves is like... I mean, you don't want to hold them too much because it's not good for them. But it's like, I want to be right there with it and smell it.
Yeah, I think you get to a certain level where you think, what's the point? It's almost like they feel compelled to do this activity, to be involved in this activity without any stepping back and think, why am I doing this? Or what benefit is there to me for doing this or to this place or these species? You mentioned that seasonality as well. Well, you sort of did with what you're saying about when the potatoes are ready, that's when you go for the salmon. Is how much does seasonality then come into this interaction between you and nature and food? Well, you've got it in the garden here, but outside of that.
So it's all, and that's the reason I divide the book very simply into 12 chapters, 12 months, because there's all the different things we do. You know, whether it's the salmon smolt run in May or pheasant shooting starts in November, October, whatever it is. So if you can live with those seasons, and we all obviously go to shops or whatever, I can't produce everything in my own little garden here. But when you've got all those seasonal things, it just connects you. So last night we had new potatoes and I've got, do you know what garlic scapes are? Mm-hmm. You know, the lovely flower stems. So it's actually elephant garlic. So it's actually a type of leek, right? So you get a really big scape. So those chopped up with fresh thyme and some butter, put over the potatoes that I've just dug up and I've only boiled them. So they're still a bit hard in the center. That is totally seasonal. That is now June, right? That is it.
Yeah.
And the garlic scapes, the thyme and the potatoes are just perfect. So yeah, I bought some new Jersey Royals for a couple of months ago and I was not really that impressed with them for what they cost, to be honest. What I had last night, And so in all through the year, you've got that. Mm. So it's the first parsnips or the first peas or whatever it is you take. It just gives you that added oomph.
It's a lot of work though, isn't it? It's a lot of planning and time and patience to be able to get this into your life.
Yeah, it's not really cost effective either.
No, it's not the cheapest way to live. No.
It's not the cheapest way to live. I always say the only thing that's cheaper is your potatoes and your runner beans and your French beans.
Yeah.
And everything's organic here. There's no sprays in the garden, whatever. So that probably makes it even harder as well. So it's a thing you do for love. But if I go back to when I was a kid, you know, every house had a vegetable garden at the back. Mm-hmm. And we seemed, and somehow we had the time. I never quite understood, and because I come from the IT industry, all these things we do is to give us more time You remember we said when we had computers, we wouldn't need paper anymore. We'd never be printing things off, right? And we just use more and more paper now. Yeah. I spent a lot of time. But in the summer, this time of year, you can be out there at 6 o'clock in the morning or 8 o'clock in the evening. Yeah.
So Richard Mabey's 1972 book, Food for Free, is always this thing that's possibly the forager's bible still, yeah. But there's a lie within that title, because it's food in exchange for time, and it's that time expense as well, and to build up the experience to be able to do it and find out what works and what doesn't, and to be able to say, okay, well, I've tried five different ways to do this thing, actually this is the way that works for me in my garden or in my life or whatever it is. Is that partly why you tried to put things down into those months for the book then? Was that you sharing the ways that you had found best to live for you?
Yes, it's probably already out of date. yes, because it's what's probably foremost in my mind in that particular month. So if I go back to, say, March this year, I know I got a picture there about some potatoes chitting in a box, right? And then there's always that big question, to chit your potatoes or not to chit your potatoes? Mm. Does it make any difference?
Yeah.
And at the end of the day, you put them in, they will grow. Mm. Where it makes a difference is if you chit them, when you put them in the ground, they're going to pop up a bit quicker. But if you put them in too early, obviously they pop up, then the frost will get them.
Yeah.
So it's just using that as an example, your potatoes there, just that one month in March, it's like potatoes, chit, and at the end of the, towards the end of March, I put them in the ground, the compost comes out from the bottom of the garden, you dig them all and put them all in. And so it becomes a thing I do every March, yeah? And that's really what we're talking about month by month. Every month there's something differently I will be doing that month. And to give people an idea, because I talk so much to people about trying to get people to see more what's around them. So if you can box it in, if you like, by month, it'll help them visualize it, actually what is around.
What is the book called? What would people expect to find in it? Because it's a nature book, but not.
Yeah. So it's interesting. I've learned, this is the first book I've had published, right? So I did the book, and then it went to publish, and they go, well, what genre is it? I said, well, it's a bit of cooking from the garden, lots of wildlife, conservation, field sports, all these things I love and all these things I do each month. So it's multi-genre then? Yeah. Oh, we don't do that. We do single genre books. Do you do a book about fly fishing, or a book about potato gardening, or a book about fluffy bunnies? That's what we do. But I said, that's not that, but that's missing the point. They're all together. Then I get on my ranting bit. He says, but we've lost, the whole point is bringing this all together as one. And that's the message I'm trying to get in the book, right? And everyone, if they go down a single road, they miss the context, the hinterland of what actually life out there is all about.
So not siloing everything and seeing the interconnectedness of things, seeing how everything, one thing is dependent on the other. So you could have the life cycle of the fluffy bunny, and then the reason to control it, the methods to control it, then how to cook it and what to cook it with.
Yeah, because otherwise a wild rabbit on its own is never just a wild rabbit on its own.
No.
It exists there for a reason and part of that whole ecosystem.
We have this, so the audience for this podcast is, as far as we can tell, largely people who either already have some aspect of wild food in their life, or they want to integrate more wild food into their diet, and it's something they want to do for probably a number of different reasons. But the access to it and how to get started into it and the nuance of, well, how do I bring this in? Sometimes we find that when we get questions on courses and people write in, they say, you know, what book should I get to learn about this? What book should I, where should I go to learn about this thing? And I often reply with okay, here's seven books. You know, here's seven things. Because to me, that is all the same subject. You can't just say foraging on its own. It's like, okay, you have to actually learn a bit about plant identification because that's a skill set on its own. And then you have to be able to read a habitat and the difference between chalk and downland and then where we are, which is clay and limestone. That makes a huge difference to what you're going to find. So I'm really looking forward to your book. Because I saw it. It's I was going to buy it, and then you said, "Do you want to be on the podcast?" I went, "Yeah, yeah, fine. Going to have a free book."
It looks like you've got it. It's in your hands.
Yeah. I'm just going to stop the podcast and start reading
you've
got, it.
You've achieved your objective today.
Yeah, so that's it. Thank you very much. When did it come out?
So let me ask you first question when it came out. It came out May the 30th, so it's just out.
Yeah.
So the bit about where do you start and what books do you recommend? Mm. So it's a bit like if you were starting doing a vegetable garden, and that can be really daunting. Mm. I've got a garden and I've got no veg in it. Where do I start, right? So you could just do a raised bed as a simple way. Just start with one raised bed that you can manage, because you don't want to get it all manageable full of weeds and go, well, that was a waste of time.
Yeah.
And that's really what in the book, I've just called out some things that each sort of month I like to cook. So you could just start there and bring it back to your foraging. It was actually an article I read in Scrypan. So I really don't like mayo and mustard and ketchup and all the goopy things like that. It's just none of me. So if I have a salad, I like a really simple salad to put on there, which is same parts olive oil, fresh squeezed lemon juice, and some honey, and shake. Get a little screw top jam jar and shake it up. Right, that's also what I like to do. Anyway, so this year, what's that? Even 2 days ago, I've got lettuces. Well, obviously it's a salad. And I take the beetroot tops this time of year and cut some of those, some of the bean tops, some of the peas tops. But I discovered a new thing: ground elder, and it's really nice and nutty and crunchy. Yeah. And it was in, I think it was in the, anyway, some Scrypan thing, and. Well, there's a bit of foraging just easy in the garden, and it's a pain if you're a gardener, ground elder as well, right? So it's really nice to eat it. So when you first start in the spring, you know, you haven't got many lettuces there, but you want to start eating stuff as soon as you can. You know, half of it I'd put ground elder in because it just bulked up the whole thing. Yeah. And then you start thinking, wow, I wonder what goodness is in that, right? Because none of that's come from, there's no food miles, there's no chemicals, just growing in my garden.
It's a byproduct of the landscape.
It's a complete byproduct of the landscape. So that's my bit about the that. But back to the book. So it's actually only, it's published 30th day of May.
Hmm. And we're right at the beginning of June recording this now, so this is fresh.
This is fresh. It's fresh because there was a printer problem thing I won't go into all that, which delayed it about 2-3 months.
But anyway,
don't worry about that. But it is all out now, and I actually start in April, so we're 2 months behind on that. The first chapter is April because I just think that's when the whole world wakes up for me here.
So let's talk about, because now we've got the book out of the way and people can go and back. There's a link to the book. There's a link to John's writing as well on Scrypound, all in the show notes for this episode. So you can see that we're in this ecosystem. You and I both of sort of writers and people who talk about nature related to food and related to other things. And something it's been a topic for a while, but it really is under discussion at the moment, is salmon farming and the effects of salmon farming. So You've got some high level involvement with this, haven't you? Can you explain a little bit about what you do and what maybe frame the problem for people, because it's not always easy to understand.
No, and quite rightly, people can see it as a lovely, cheap, tasty bit of protein.
Beautiful orange omega-3.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it probably hit home to me probably 10, 12 years ago when I was working in the US a lot. Mm. And you walk into a what's called Whole Foods supermarket in Austin, in Texas, and you got all the fish there, whatever, from, I think it's changed the name now, the Gulf of Mexico or something anyway.
Yeah.
And there would be salmon there, right? Big sign, Scottish salmon. I thought, wow, it's a long way from home. Fresh from beautiful pictures of lochs and all the rest of it. Yeah. I'm looking at it going, well, that's not wild salmon, because we don't kill wild salmon anymore. There aren't enough. So that has to be, and you look at it and you look at the tails and you can see, yeah, that's farm salmon. Wow. So here we are in America, only 10, 12 years ago, if that, and they are all buying this salmon, which they would just believe it's come out of the seas, the wonderful wild seas around Scotland, yeah? So obviously that gets me thinking, and I know because I've fished a salmon for years, I know how the species has gone down an awful lot. So we have a situation now where I'm assuming people, let's say they assume they don't know what I'm going to say.
Let's go from the basics.
Let's go from the basics. So there is no such thing as wild salmon sold in the UK.
No.
Doesn't exist. The only wild salmon you can buy in the UK is sockeye salmon from Canada. Mm-hmm. Okay. So all the salmon, therefore, from the UK, and it usually calls it Scottish because it tends to be Scotland because the water's a bit colder, is farmed. Mm-hmm. And so number one, a lot of the public don't even know that fact.
Right.
So, okay, so they now know it's farmed, John. So what's the problem with that? Because that sounds good. Because originally, when we started doing farmed salmon, it was all that take the pressure off the wild salmon. Mm. And that was sounded like a good thing, right? And it probably did reduce poaching in the old days when there was enough there to poach. But the way it's produced... Mm-hmm. And the thousands and thousands of fish in a small it's in a net, right? So they tend to be in the sheltered side of Scotland, more in the locks where you can shelter them from the high seas. So they get the tide coming through, so it's cleaner and the water's colder. It's better for the fish. But it is intensive farming, just like any other intensive farming. If you put thousands of pigs in a shed or cows or whatever else it may be, and what happens when you have intensive farming? You get problems with disease. And unfortunately for the poor old salmon and the way its lifestyle works is there's a little creature called a parasite called a sea lice, which by name it can only survive in the sea. And that all these thousands of fish congregating, it congregates in there and starts eating.
It's a buffet for sea lice.
A complete buffet for them.
Yeah.
And then there were, so you say, okay, so what? So there are two big things that come from that. One is that, you know, on the salmon's life journey, when they're eggs in the rivers and they spend a couple of years there, and they come down as smolts, go out to sea, and they go all the way across to Iceland and Greenland. So on the way, they have to pass through these estuaries and these locks where all these salmon are cooped up, and the sea lice are there, and they attach themselves to the young smolts. And the smolt is, what, 20 millimetres long, is that? Yeah. No, what are we talking about?
200?
200. I'm mixing my centimeters and things. Yeah, about that big. I'm showing it to get some help here on the size.
It's about that far.
It's about that big, but you can't see. Yeah, about that far. Two or three of those on it can kill it. And so, if you're killing all the smolts, which then become the adult salmon, then you've got a big problem. The other problem is obviously the salmon themselves, the farm ones, because they die as well.
Yeah.
And you know, you read some of the numbers of the, they have to now. By law, they have to say how many of their fish die. I mean, we are talking thousands and thousands of thousands.
It's not one or two.
It's not one or two. If you had cows in a field and like 60% of them sometimes, whatever, are dying, whatever, they're just lying there, you know, you'd be chased off that farm straight away. So it's massive death in them. And then, of course, there's all the chemicals and stuff they go on to put in to try and kill the lice, right, to... So we talk about worrying at the moment about chlorinated chicken from America. What about the stuff you're eating here? from a salmon point of view. And I you know, there's lots of work that's being done. I just can't understand, back to basics, why you would eat that stuff, why there aren't more government regulations, but obviously there's the money involved. And let me tell you a quick story about Canada.
Please do.
So... West Coast of Canada, we've got five species of salmon. They have, you know, it's that same problem on lice, etc. But it wasn't until the parasites from the farm salmon in the cages infected the herring stocks, and the herring fleet then was going bankrupt, and it was the herring fishermen that finally got the governments on the west coast of Canada to ban open net salmon farming. Now, there's a couple of things there. As you go, well, you know, luckily it hasn't affected necessarily our herring, but you go, if the farm salmon can end up with parasites that kill off the herring, well, what are they doing potentially to us? And we eat this stuff.
And there's all these things about they're adding you're adding things to it as well to change the color of the fish. Yeah. And they add omega-3 in the food.
Yeah, because I think there's a they should naturally have it right from their food. And by the way, that's the other massive thing. So what do we feed them on? We feed them on fish meal. So we catch thousands, thousands of tons of fish, and a lot of them off West Africa, and right, to feed them. So we are decimating the small fish in the food chain to feed our love of salmon.
And it requires sort of a basic understanding of a food chain to say, like, if you take out the stuff at the bottom end, that's going to affect every species above it. Everything that eats that, and everything that eats that one, and everything that eats that one, it cascades upwards, or in fact collapses.
Whatever way you look at it, right? I think we're harming humans, right? With actually eating it, we're obviously harming the salmon and sea trout that migrate through. We're harming all those other countries and food chains that suck up all this food, and the expansion is the Scottish salmon farming is like they're talking about massive expansion still going on. So we haven't even finished yet.
No. There's a lot of money in this industry as well, isn't there? There's at least enough to make people carry on regardless of the ecological effect.
Yeah. So and I understand that. You know, there are jobs and the money. I would argue that there was probably nowadays, if you had no salmon farms along the West Coast, you could in theory have a lot more wild fish and more wild fishing and hotels, and you could get your more tourism back. That's certainly a possibility. But at the end of the day, it is big money, and I get that. But there is a solution. This is the crazy thing, because if I just shout and rant at the Scottish government and they say, but we're getting all this money for tax that pays for all this, then it's not an argument. Yeah, it doesn't really work. But there is a solution where you can just put them in closed contained tanks. On land.
Yeah.
You could do that. You could just solve the problem. Now, sure, it will cost some money, but you could even have a transition subsidy or something to do that, yeah? But every year, nothing happens.
It's difficult to get your head around if you haven't looked into the subject, just how many of these farms there are. But if you go on Google Maps and go look at the aerial view, or go on Google Earth, or whatever your satellite viewer of choice is, and just go and look at the west coast of Scotland, sort of start, I don't know, around Oban, and move, and just look around there, and just follow the coastline up. And every time you see either a little grid of squares out in a lock in one of the inlets, or often a ring as well, you see that, and then you can see the infrastructure that's attached to it as well, because often there's a jetty on shore and there's stuff there, and there are all these other parallel effects, like controlling seals, because the seals then go into the tanks to predate on the salmon, which means then people are brought in to shoot the seals and control the seals. And then there's chemicals and the sort of treatment for those fish, for the lice and everything else, ends up just in the open sea, in these locks. Yeah. And that has a cascading effect onto the shellfish and to what's building up in there once you've got your filter feeders. We've come across this with my other job, when I work with, I work with the military and work with people related to wild food, subjects related to wild food. We have to make a risk assessment about where we're taking people to. And the salmon farms actually came into that, because when we're dealing with shellfish and filter feeders and bivalves, the proximity to a salmon farm does affect the health of that food source there on shore. So it's not, there's not many ways you can look at it and think, yeah, but it's quite good for this. Basically, they provide employment, but if you can retain the employment and that money in the area, there has to be another way, and that bringing it on land.
And with climate change, it's getting worse, because as our seas warm up, the lice increase as well. So it's getting worse, worse and worse. And then, you know, the desert underneath these cages as well, where all this crap just literally falls down there. What I try to do in the book a bit is to bring it home is all using my own observations, real life experience. I can remember, and I read about it one year, I'm in North Uist, and we go sea trout fishing in North Uist in October. So like the last trip of the year. And it's you know, the beautiful, wild, idyllic place. Well, the wildest place in the whole of the UK, really. You're right on the western seaboard there. But you've got these salmon farms. And I can remember getting out of the road there, and it's quite windy often there. And this smell, it hit you, right? And you go, oh. And the first of all, I thought it was like, you know, you get a build up of seaweed over the summer and it starts to rot. It's a bit like that, but it was worse than that. And then this big truck went by and a big container, and there was a pothole in the road, and the big lorry went boom over the pothole. And a load of liquid just sort of spilt out really, really close to me. And I went, whoa, there's that smell. Anyway, I found out that truck was going to the open pit just up the road in the sand dunes where they put all the dead salmon from the salmon farms in North Uist. And not only that, and I've got a couple of pictures there of the pit in the book, it's open. And there were seagulls and gulls all feeding on there, right? And actually going in there, and then they're going in the sea. And then I'm standing visibly, it looks like a pristine estuary. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful. There's geese, everything else there. You're in the absolute wilderness, and people do and will pay money to do that. And I'm thinking, but wow, all those sea trout have got to come past all that stuff.
It's hidden away from most people's view as well, because it's not something that people are stumbling across every day. You have to go quite a long way out
exactly.
there. It's, I mean, if we got in the cars now to drive there, I don't think even in the middle of summer we'd get there before sunset.
No.
This fact that it's hidden away from view means it's somehow lower in the national priorities. You could find more people around here and where we are and in most parts of England and Wales who would have an opinion on pheasant shooting and pheasant releases and things like that, which I can happily argue, there is an issue there in some places. I would say this is a higher priority. If we're going to fix something first, I'm going to choose the salmon fishing and the salmon farming rather. But it's this thing of, because it's not visible to you, and it's not easy for you to see some evidence of it with your own eyes, it's harder for you to find it as a priority, maybe.
And we've cut people off so much from health. You know, if you're vegan, it's different, right? Or vegetarian, okay? But if you eat meat, and obviously include fish in that, things die, right? And we've cut people so off, they don't see that. They'll just go to the supermarket and they'll buy the salmon. It doesn't interfere with them, and they don't seem to want to know. There was a recent, they've just allowed, the first time ever now, that they can call salmon. They don't have to put farmed in front of it. Mm. Now, in some ways, you could say, well, it's irrelevant because it's all farmed anyway. So what, you don't put a cow, it's farmed cow. Okay, although actually Jeremy Clarkson's saying this is farmed cow, which I make my moo juice from. But anyway, they don't even say farm because it's all farmed anyway. Mm. But it says something that, when you've got all these problems going, we didn't. The one bit we had in there was to differentiate, to try and make people think was farmed, and even that's been taken away now.
Yeah, it's easy to throw around words around biodiversity and nature crisis and things like that, but there's so much nuance to all of these things. It's almost you have to put some effort into being exhausted by having to research it and having to spend a lot of time thinking about it, but it is worth it because you end up with a greater understanding of everything that's going on in these places. But that then cascades backwards to all your arguments and the way you view everything else.
And that's a bit like what you're talking about. You know, if you're going to start foraging for wild food, where do you start? Or start a garden, where do you start? What I try to do in the book is say, look, make you a little bit more curious about some of these conservation topics, which are very relevant at the moment.
Yeah.
So salmon farming, got in there, just to, you might still eat your salmon, whatever, but just to make you think about some questions. And there's a few sort of teasers in there to actually bring it to the fore.
Yeah, the event we were at this weekend, there was a Spanish guy there, a young Spanish guy, he's working on the estate where the event was being held. I spent quite a bit of time talking to him because he wants to hunt. He's 21 and he, you know, grew up wanting to hunt, and he's hunting, and now he was talking about the opportunity to hunt in the UK and the access to it and the access to food. And we ended up having quite a good conversation about, okay, what do you want? Do you want to hunt or do you want to have wild food? You know, what are the two? If your driver is to access that wild food, then there are other ways to do it. You know, particularly where in the corner of the country that is, befriend a stalker, befriend a deer manager, because if you are helpful enough to them, you will end up with a deer carcass. If you want venison, if that's what you want, and that's that's part of it. It's when people ask me those questions now about, you know, how do I get into this? The question I go back with is, okay, what do you actually want to do? Do you want to find wild food or do you want to have wild food? Because if it's a bit of both, that's fine. I can give you one bit of advice. If it's find wild food, probably less interest in helping you. But if it's if it's having wild food and finding it yourself or just having it as a food source, then there are more routes open to you that are in line with the conservation struggles that we have and the challenges that we're going to face here. And for some part of that, it might be, well, actually, do you want seasonal food? Do you want food that's actually in rhythm with nature, which can come from farm sources? It can, or you can grow it yourself, or you can seek out people who are growing it in a certain way. You know, we think about where we get our meat from. A lot of it comes from basically two farms, they're both in the same valley, that are friends of mine. But I've worked hard to make sure they're my friends because I want meat from those people, you know, because I like the way they farm.
But what you're saying is because probably where do you start?
Yeah.
I'd probably say the very first thing you should start with is food miles.
Yep.
Then the whole provenance of it all and the rest of it as well. And it might be wild or whatever. Mm. But start on that. Mm. Then you go to your seasonal piece.
Yeah.
And it sort of, that's a book, isn't it? You start, how do you start this? And the same whether it's meat or vegetables or completely wild foraged plants. Start local, start small and bring it up like that. But then what happens if everybody did that, when we'd have nothing if you strip the country bare.
No, but even if it's but if you start local and reducing your food miles, then you do have to accept with that you're not going to be able to get everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're not going to get low food mile avocados here. And I mean,
avocados.
But also low food mile walnuts, raisins, you know, really basic stuff. It's not going to happen where we are. I mean, unless I can really get on well with a local vineyard, my raisin and sultana intake isn't going to go well.
You always just say, well, don't bring me a problem, bring me a solution, right? So, and you talked right at the very beginning about we have to have a different conversation here because we're just getting all polarized in our views, yeah? And we have to find some alternative here. I'm offering an alternative for salmon farming.
Mm-hmm.
Work out some transition period to bring in things to contain thing, and then sure, everyone have your cheap good proteins. Cool. I think that's the way we have to do it. I just think sometimes there are too many shouty, ranting people on stuff, and wherever we have a problem in any of this, we have to say, well, here's an alternative.
Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. It will basically come down to giving up some of the convenience of what we have at the moment on food.
You have to sort of stop and see work out what the problem is now and work on that solution rather than folding in your current solution to that problem into the thing you're going to go forward with. So rather than finding ways to get all the things you eat now locally, think about what you can get locally and seasonally and start from that.
And I think that's what I do with the vegetable garden. The vegetable garden, I start with, well, that's what I've got. So what goes well with that? That's a sort of starting point. The nicest thing, I know everybody can't do this, is just see a pigeon breast, right? And there's lots and lots of pigeons. Mm. And to do that with a simple salad described from the garden.
Yeah.
Well, fine. I don't need to go to Waitrose for that, and that will just it'll give me a buzz as well.
So reframing what your idea of what food is that there's that example, isn't there, of the beef burger, a beef burger with a tomato and salad on it. Yeah. How long the chain of supply is to get that? Because you've got to make the bread, you're gonna make the flour, you've got to have the beef, you've got to get the onion, the salad. Each one of those single ingredients has this long chain of supply behind it, whereas pigeon breasts in a salad. Or pigeon breast with some steamed vegetables or something like that. You could literally source all of that from your garden. I saw the pigeon earlier.
Yes, there's plenty of pigeons. The dopey pigeons always around. You know the old country thing there used to be is you get the pigeon in the winter and you're feeding on the kale tops and you from the crops you take the you'd get your veg and your meat in one.
Well, this thing about local food and that short loop, it's not. Because the words permaculture, the word permaculture and then regen farming are sort of used almost interchangeably at the moment, and people are using permaculture a lot to link into wild food and gardening. And if you look back further into British history, not that long ago as well, within the last sort of the last 100 years, the last 150 years, there were places in the UK that were doing that by default. They were doing that because they needed to, because economic factors meant, okay, we couldn't bring in anything in. So everything on this estate had to be grown from things that we can make on this estate.
Yeah.
So whether it's the soil, whether it's the materials from woodland, I think about places like the Elvedon estate in the early part of the 20th century had to find ways to bring, get all of their inputs from their own land, which meant they had to design the farm to bring everything to it, which is basically permaculture. But it wasn't called that at the time because no one had invented the term.
There's another problem there at the moment, I think, in the community is you got the increase in, say, in contract farming.
Yes.
To come back to that. So then you're bringing people in and they're getting paid X an acre to do whatever and get out. And you've lost that local, should be a local person that did that, who knows that particular field and everything else. And so all these things are sort of dissolving in a way, coming back to the local community type stuff.
And the community is a big part of that because that was local employment for people as well, because your employment was directly tied to your link to that place.
Yeah.
And that's something we're trying to do with other work and another organization that we've set up, is trying to link people to that landscape in a way that benefits both, because it has to work both ways.
Just very quickly, talk about landscape. I've been involved in this GCC for Natural History.
Oh, yeah.
That's... which, wow, what a path that's been, because it was finally got there and then we had the election last year and then Labour then said, no, that's a Tory initiative. It's completely non-political, this, right? This is GCC for Natural History to get... Anyway, thank God that they've now agreed it can go through, which is really recent.
And it's recent news.
Really recent news, and I write quite a bit about that, because I think it's so important, because there's two things in there. One is all this, and I worry, and I know I showed you around my other sort of man cave earlier in the house, it's sort of all older generation stuff that's still dying out, right? Two things. If we don't get the kids involved in this, we're always going to be completely... chasing our tails. So we've got to get them in. And the other thing, I've lost my point now, I was going to say on the... Oh, that was right. So if you take the GC for Natural History, so National GC, OCR Exam Board, blah, 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 does all that. And let's assume 80% of it is wherever you take in the country, it's the same questions. And by the way, there's a lot of fieldwork type stuff. So for those kids that aren't quite so good at writing long essays, you can bring that into it. But you keep 20% of it for the local natural history. Isn't that a wonderful concept? Because then you bring people back to the local landscape. And of course, that'll be different if you're on that secret place on the North Pennine Moors you're talking about, or you're sitting here in lowland southern Chalkland. And again, it's just bringing another thing of all these things together to make it work.
That's been a worry of mine with the GCSE, but I've spoken to a few people now involved in it, and everyone's reassured me so far that this isn't going to be the case, that it would be so easy for that to then become a natural history GCSE about someone else's natural history. And it's like, okay, for this natural history GCSE, this whole section is going to be about Kenya, which is vitally important for Kenyans.
But there are lots of kids who know more about the wildlife in Kenya than they know about the wildlife here.
It doesn't solve a problem here.
No, it doesn't solve. And that is the... bless, obviously, David Attenborough and all those other things. But for too long, we've shown things about lions and elephants, the rest of it.
Yeah.
And we've forgotten what wonderful things we have here in the UK. And if you only connect kids to lions in Africa, you need to connecting to stuff here which they can see every day.
Yeah.
And that doesn't have to be, by the way, a puffin or bottlenose dolphin or something sort of exotic like that, right? It can be the simple type of bumblebee you've got here or whatever it is,
And it's no wonder, to some degree, that there is such an anxiety about nature and climate with the young generation, when it's actually we've made it very hard for them to be able to look out of the window and see something that's there.
Yeah.
You know, all the things you showed us on the walk to this building.
Yeah.
You're talking about this. You're talking about the so it's a wagtail and yeah. bite fly catchers and the looking at the bumblebee nests down here by the edge of the patio. So many teachers would walk past all this and just go, well, it's a nice garden, but there's nothing really here.
Yeah.
Because they aren't trained to see what's there. And that, I really hope that will be the output from this GCSE.
It'll take at least a year to train teachers to feel comfortable and empowered to talk about that as well. So that in itself is a challenge. But, you know, the final curriculum, if you like, isn't quite scoped yet. Mm. And I hope it does do that, because what I would want people to do is, if they walk from the house to the building we're in now, is to see all the stuff I see. And if they can see all the stuff that I see, then we've achieved what we want to achieve. And their life will be so much more enriched as well.
I think that's a good place to wrap it up. So, John, where can people find your book? Where can people find out more about you and your writing?
Well, I do. If you live around here in Wiltshire, I'll give a plug to the local bookshop, the White Horse Bookshop in Marlborough, obviously. And I will be there on the 19th of June giving a talk about it, 6 p.m. if you're local. But it's anywhere these days. Any bookshops, Amazon, Waterstones, it's
you're everywhere.
It's everywhere now. That's what's great. Yeah, it's everywhere.
Do you have a website?
And I have a website. So it's johnmillernature.com.
Yeah.
And that's where I do signed copies if people want to buy signed copies.
Okay. And people can find you there, and then you're on social media as well.
Yeah. So johnmillernature.com. I've got a blog on there, so you've got the latest things that's going on. I put different articles on there, and there's a media gallery of stuff and et cetera. So hopefully you'll like that. I write in Scribehound quite a bit, as you know, but it's a great world out there, all this stuff.
It's a good time for conservation communication and talking about nature and talking about connections to this world.
Yeah, I think absolutely right. I think hopefully we've reached a point now where there's enough of us, probably because some of us have come up to retirement, actually, to say, well, we got to do something here. And there's just about enough of us left to actually try and get those communications out there. Because, that's very needed.